Today is April 6th, 2010. I'm Sherry Bowers, local history coordinator of the Milan-Berlin Township Public Library, and I'm here with Janine Williams to talk about the Milan area and her work here as a teacher and principal and share some stories with us today. And first of all, I would like you, please, Janine, to talk about Milan. You grew up here, correct? You were born in Milan. Can you give us a little background?
Yes, I was born in 1939 in Milan Township, and I grew up out on the corner here in Avery and Scheid Road. My parents had a farm out there, and we raised potatoes and sweet corn, all kinds of produces. Plus, we had hay and wheat, things like that. So I had a very busy childhood. There were four of us, and we worked on that farm. Did a lot of things after school. In the springtime, it was kind of funny. We each had to take a day off from school so that we could help on the farm, which back in those days, that was considered okay. There were many times when I resented all that work, but gave me a good work ethic, so I thank my parents for that. I married John Williams, who lived here in Milan in 1959. We raised three children. We built a house out on River Road, so I've been here for 63 years of my life. So I remarried in 2002 and moved to Florida. I kept my house up here, so I come back and forth because this is where my children and grandchildren are. One interesting thing about being here for this long, my family has four generations that graduated from either Milan High School or Edison High School. My father, myself, all three children. I had two grandchildren that have graduated, and my five grandchildren are in school here, so we've stuck.
A lot of history with the community.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I want to talk for a while. We can go back to some of this, but let's kind of zero in for the reason also that we're having the interview. 20 years ago, Larry Lambert took a series of photographs of people around Milan at the time. Some were not lifelong residents, but anyhow, this is a wonderful picture of you in one of the classrooms at Milan Elementary, mm-hmm. and you're standing next to a chalkboard, which now you would be standing next to a smart board. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, you know, I always like to hear the stories of when did you know you wanted to go into the teaching profession?
Well, at first I thought I wanted to be a nurse. And then I had a case of appendicitis and had to go to the hospital. And then I decided I didn't want to be a nurse. And in high school, I joined FTA, Future Teachers of America, and was assigned to a first grade teacher. I just loved her. Her name was Ella Schaefer, and she and I got along very well. She would let me do a lot of things with the kids. And I spent 2 years working with her. You know, if I had a study hall or something like that, I'd go down and work with her. And after that, I knew I wanted to be a teacher. When I started out, I graduated in 1957, and there was a shortage of teachers then. You know, if you could walk and speak a sentence, you know, you could almost come into the classroom. So the state of Ohio started what they called a cadet teaching program. You could go to school for 2 years, and then you could get a certificate, a temporary certificate, and teach. And so that's what I decided to do. At that time, first of all, girls didn't go to college, usually, it was something that I wanted to do, and Bowling Green started an off-campus program, and it was held at Sandusky High School. So I enrolled there. I got a $100 scholarship from the Milan Mothers Club, and that summer after I graduated, Mr. Lindy Camp, who was my mentor, came out to the house, and he said, "We have a large kindergarten class, and we are going to start a new program using educational aides to come in and help the teacher. I think there were about 50 students that year in the morning class, and about that many in the afternoon class. And he said, would you be interested in taking this job on and go to school, you know, at night, which is the only time you could go to school when you were at Sandusky High School. And, oh, I was excited. I thought, oh, yes, I want to do this. My dad didn't think that was a good thing, and it was the only time I heard my mother stand up to him and said, if this is what she wants to do, she's going to do it. So that's what I did. And I learned more those 2 years than I did in most of my college classes, because it was hands-on experience. Mm-hmm. So after those 2 years, I did get my temporary certificate. I worked at Margaret. I helped start their kindergarten program. You know, here I was, 19 years old, and what did I know, you know? Mm-hmm. That was exciting. I worked there for a year, and then went to Huron for 3 years. And with this cadet program, you could work for the 4 years, but then you had to renew that temporary certificate. Well, in the meantime, I got married. I had 2 children, another one on the way, and I got in a few classes, but not that many, so I stopped after the 4 years, and I was off about 2 years. And my oldest daughter was ready to start first grade, and they couldn't find a first grade teacher. They had four classes, and they needed the fourth teacher. So I called Mr. Lindekamp and said to him, I said, I'll help out, you know, because I thought, you know, it would only be a temporary position because I didn't have a certificate yet. And he worked and got me a temporary certificate, and I went in, and I said, now, as soon as you find a teacher, let me know, and, you know, well, he never looked, I don't think, but I was there ever since. And you know, it was so strange coming back to the same school that I went to school mm-hmm. in. But I was there until I retired after that. So
when you got that certificate, did you have to still, though, continue with continuing ed classes? And, of course, you went on to become a principal.
Mm-hmm. Right. It took me till I think I got my bachelor's degree in 1970. So, you know, I was raising 3 children, had a husband, and working full-time. But I could get temporary certificates as long as I took, you know, some classes mm-hmm. during the year, then I could get that temporary certificate renewed until I got my bachelor's. And then it took me another 10 years to get my administration and supervision certificate. But it was worth it. A lot of work, though. A lot of drives to Bowling Green.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, people don't realize how much time is spent, you know, besides, well, after the education, how much time is spent on the continuing ed and all the things that teachers need to do to stay certified and write plans. And tell me about teaching at that time, because you were mostly in the primary grades, correct?
Right.
So was it mostly first grade, or did you kind of switch to other
Well,
grades?
When I first went in, I was just first grade. I taught first grade for 2 years. And Mr. Lindekamp and Mrs. Barber, who was the principal at that time, were very innovative. And they had heard about team teaching or cooperative teaching. And so Mrs. Barber was a good administrator. She'd throw out some ideas, and I learned this from her. You throw out the idea, and, you know, you just walk away from it, and pretty soon, you know, we started talking about it, and pretty soon one of us would say, okay, why don't we try this? And I had another teacher, in fact, it was the other teacher that was also the afternoon kindergarten aide when I was the morning aide. She and I decided that we'd be willing to try team teaching, the two of us together. And so we had probably 40 or 50 kids, you know, at that time. Class size wasn't a big issue. It should have been, but we worked together and got along really well. They brought in a professor from Ohio University who was very pro team teaching and in-serviced a lot of us that were interested in this. And so from that started the team teaching program. The first couple of years it was just first that teamed, and then we expanded into second and then into third, so that there was a primary team, first, second, and third. And the reason we did that was because we also had a program called Continuous Progress, which took the child where he was or she was, and they moved, the material moved along with the child rather than the child moving into the material, so to speak. So that if they finished the first grade book in first grade, they went into second grade book, let's say. Or if they were only three quarters of the way through the first grade book and doing well, that book would go on with them, or those skills would go on with them. So this is why we found that putting first, second, and third together worked well. Back to your question, I taught first, second, and third, but I mainly taught language arts, reading and English, handwriting, that type of thing.
Was that, I know that certificates used to read K through 8, and you mentioned teaching just a couple core subjects. Was that always the case? Because I know certificates today are, I guess for lack of a better word, seem a little bit more rigid because you have to specialize in a couple of core areas, certain grades, 4 through 6. I'm not sure how it goes anymore, but like my old certificate, Social Studies Comprehensive 7 through 12, which allows for much more flexibility because you can teach middle school and can teach high school. When you were teaching, was that always the case? For the most part, you taught core areas?
You had to take some more classes. I think there was three more classes you took in order to get certified in kindergarten. Because there was a K-8 and then there was a 1-8. But, you know, you could go into middle school and teach any subject, which you can't now. But at that point, you know, I could have taught any subject in middle school, too, if I so desired. But that's changed.
What about teaching methods? Because, you know, I know that things change just like, we sometimes it seems like we go back to what we used to do. During your time, are there any big changes that you can talk about or things that you think really were, wow, this is great, or things that you wish that they wouldn't have dropped in terms of some of the teaching methods that are used?
Well, I think, you know, what do they say about education? What comes around goes around, and what goes around comes around. So that 25 years from now, we may be doing some of the things that we did 50 years ago. You know, somebody will say, oh, this is a great idea, let's try it. So I think technology changed all that. I don't think you can go back to doing some of the things that we did when I was teaching because of technology. It's just opens up so many more avenues that we didn't have. You know, when I was teaching, you know, there was a book, there was me, there would be film strips, maybe, if you were lucky, you know. And we had the old Ditto machine that the kids loved when you ran off something because they could smell that. And, you know, we don't even have those things in the schools anymore other than the books and the teachers, you know. So that much has changed. But I think with, you know, with the computers, the smart boards, just all the technology has put a strain on teachers because they have to compete with that type of thing. And there are still basic skills, especially in the elementaries, that need to be taught. And I don't know how you teach them unless you just, you know, you get out the book, you get out the flashcards, you do that type of thing in order to give them those basic skills, because how can they turn on a computer and look for something if they don't know how to read? And how do you learn how to read other than, you know, what we've done for years. And of course, it's like everything else, you know, at one time it was sight word, you know, you taught only sight word, and then there was phonetic, and then finally they got wise and they put both of them together so that, you know, that part of the teaching was a little bit easier. But back to the technology, we can't bypass that anymore. You know, it's there, and these kids that come out of school without a vast knowledge on how to use technology safely will be, you know, way behind.
I know that Hobie Career Center has, they put together their high school portfolios, you know, on a disc, and, you know, of course, so, you know, anymore, and actually I spoke with Judy Monahan, who said is a principal, said that a lot of students coming out of mm-hmm. school will have a portfolio like that, you know, where you can click on, you know, different things, and, you know, even watch something that you wouldn't have been able to do is watch, you know, 10 minutes in the classroom of a teacher in the classroom and teaching a lesson or other things that you can put on that to show, you know, potential school districts. So I think that's interesting. You're right. It is such a part of what we do now. But, you know, I looking at the picture that Larry took, I'm looking at the spelling words that you have written on the board. Please tell me what style of writing that is.
That was called Zahner Bloser, or some people call it the block.
Okay.
Writing.
And some use...
Now it's called... Well, most of the schools now use Denelian, which is... Scott Forsman publishes the Denelian program. And instead of stick, ball for a B, or little stick, you know, A for the small A, you keep your pencil on the paper and you use more of a cursive type of writing. And it took me a while. I volunteer in a school down in Florida, and I had to learn Denelian because I was used to this block. But it's very easy to learn, you know, it's just like, it's a different type. But
I suspect I've heard this, and I don't know much about it, but I imagine for teachers, especially that have since retired and taught years ago, and how technology has changed things, handwriting is an issue for some people because the penmanship is not there. I mean, I've heard that, and I, you know, every so often TV you hear people talk about the fact that, you know, we don't see the beautiful handwriting that we used to, and there's a concern that's going to go by the wayside.
My opinion is that there's so many other things that teachers are required to teach that handwriting gets kind of pushed to the side, and if there's time, we'll do it, and if there's not time, so be it. Mm-hmm. And the kids themselves don't want to take the time to learn it and to practice it because they can get on the computer and write, and it's so much easier for them. But I know I had a little issue with my grandson because one of his teachers complained to my son that I can't read his writing, and I said, okay, I'll help him. I got some stuff around, and he said, this is boring. And I said, yes, I know, but... the only way you're going to learn. So I said, someday, you know, you might not have that computer, and you're going to have to write something out that people can read. They don't understand that.
You know, and I often wonder, too, if there's a link, too, between, you know, when you look at the thought process when you're composing a sentence or a paragraph and you're taking the time, because most people cannot write very fast, at least not as fast as you could type on a computer. If maybe there's that process goes hand in hand, the thinking and the handwriting, the act of writing something out, if maybe that we lose something when we don't write out first. I know for myself, having technology come at a later age for me, I have found that I still have to oftentimes write things out, even though I can do it on the computer, or even edit I cannot edit on the computer. I still have to have that hard copy and write to myself on the margins. So technology, of course, like you said, is a big thing that's changed. Anything else? What about teaching styles with teachers? Do you find that there's some things that are still the same about teaching in terms of what teachers do when they come into the classroom? I guess when I think about the teaching methods in college, mm-hmm. are there certain things that have always been given as advice to teachers of how to, you know, conduct their classroom? And I guess everything I'm thinking from discipliners, you know, how to start your classroom. I know it changes too by grade levels, but I remember there was always that opener that most right. teachers used, and maybe that's what I'm getting at.
Oh, I think there's always going to be certain things that you have to do to get your classroom ready. You have to set up the rules with your students. We found that worked out really well, because when you've got a number of students, there has to be rules. Otherwise, there's chaos. Discipline, ways to discipline. You need to learn a lot of ways to discipline, because one way isn't going to work with every child. So it's just like being a parent. Mm-hmm. You know, there are certain things that, you know, you set your standards, and you hope that the children will abide by those standards, because the classroom has to work. They have to work with each other. And one of the things that I remember several years ago, we had a conference in Columbus, and the presenters were all business people. And the objective of the conference was what these business people wanted schools to do to prepare workers for them. And they wanted basic skills, but more important, they wanted people that could work together and that would be able to give ideas, take ideas, and not go off in a corner and pout. Mm-hmm. And that, at that point, kind of surprised me. But then when I thought about it, that is important. And so, once again, you know, in the classroom, what they called objective learning, you know, where the students would have, there would be a group of students, and you would give them something to do, and they would work on it together. And I think that's a good skill that most teachers should try to use, because, you know, there's always going to be a few that can work all better by themselves. But in today's society, if you can't get along with your coworkers, you're in trouble.
Right. Yes, you can't be an individual.
No.
Out there.
No.
I have a question to ask you. This is something that has often come up frequently. People will say, well, you know, teachers have summer off, and I had taught school for a few years, and I've always been vocal myself about that, because I don't think people understand the amount of time that's spent outside the classroom. And I can remember once a teacher telling me, when I was doing my student teaching, she said, summers are a good time to regroup. She says, yes, you are off, but that's the time you spend, you know, thinking about what went well, you know, what you need to improve on. If you need to take continuing ed classes, you're already in preparation mode for your next year. Tell me a little bit about that, because I think people need to understand what goes on, not only inside the classroom, but outside the classroom.
We can talk about that, and you hit the nail right on the head. You can talk about it, but until others live that and understand that, you know, they're still going to say, oh, you only work 9 months out of the year. Well, now it's almost 10 months, so we can, you know, argue that. But the summer, you need time to renew. You need to reflect on what you've done. You know, this went well, this didn't go well. In the constant continuing ed, if you work and you don't work an 8-hour day when you're working, mm-hmm. you know, an 8-hour day is a luxury. And I know a lot of people think, okay, you know, they go in at 8 and they leave at 3. Well, that's not here. We've always had an 8-hour day. That Mr. Lindy Camp was very firm on that way back then. You worked 8 hours, mm-hmm. and that was it. You did get a half-hour lunch time in that 8 hours, but it came 4 o'clock. You still had things to do. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of times if my kids didn't have things to do, I would stay and finish, you know, do my lesson plan or get my materials around rather than take it home. Mm-hmm. But there's always papers to grade. There's always reading that you have to do to prepare. Saturdays and Sundays, there are many a times, I think even today, if somebody would check, you'd find teachers in the buildings on Saturdays and Sundays, mainly because they wanted to work in their room or gather materials again. And the other thing, it's like being a mother. You never let it go. Mm-hmm. You're always thinking, you know, this little guy has a bad home life. Mm-hmm. And then you think, now what can I do to, and you do that in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's hard to make other people understand that mm-hmm. aren't in the profession. Or, you know, maybe, you know, other professions like nursing or, you know, where they work with mm-hmm. people might understand it better than somebody that, you know, that it makes their living in the auto factory or, you know, mm-hmm. things like that.
Yeah, there are certain professions, and I think teaching is one of them, where you don't, it never really leaves you. And you often wonder, you know, I can remember even back thinking, you know, that test question that I wrote, I'm not sure that I did a good job on that, and was, you know, was it a little misleading? And that's part of, you know, the other question I actually have for you about student teaching. You know, I think looking back, you know, the 10 weeks that I spent student teaching, it still didn't prepare me. It doesn't sink in. I have to, I had to smile when you said mm-hmm. that, you know, when you were an aide and you were in the classroom, you learned so much. And I had found that too, watching teachers in action, actually being there for multiple hours watching teachers do what they do, I think you learn so much more, because then you figure out what works for you. And I was told that by teachers that, you know, worked to mentor me during that time. Mm-hmm. So what did you do? Let's kind of go and talk a little bit about when you were principal. What did you find that, what was really important to you besides all the administrative duties that you had to do? What did you have something that you were really adamant about in terms of preparing the new teachers that you hired? Because I know there's been times they've had mentoring programs.
Mm-hmm. And they still do.
They still do?
Right.
Okay. How did you help prepare your new teachers that came in?
When I first went into the office, Mr. Sanders, who was principal at the high school, gave me some advice. And he said, spend time hiring the best people that you can find, then get out of their way.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuck. You know, I thought, you know, he's right. If I'm, and back to the teaming again, when you're working in a team of teachers, they really tend to self-evaluate themselves. It's amazing how at team meetings we talk about, this worked well for me. And another teacher would say, oh, I've never tried that. Maybe I will. I never was able to feel comfortable when I went in to evaluate teachers, only because I knew it was my job and I did a good job of it, but I often thought, you know, who am I, even though that's my job description, to say that that teacher shouldn't be doing that she just did.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard if somebody doesn't have good discipline, that's easy to see. You can see that, and mm-hmm. you can start to help correct it. You can do many things. You can have them observe a teacher that has good discipline. You can give them ideas, that type of thing. But a good teacher is almost, I say, is born mm-hmm. with the ability to do what needs to be done. And back to when I was an aide, I was so lucky that I had this good teacher to observe and to help me, because it's, you know, at first I thought, oh, you're just teaching things, you know, you're just telling them, you know, this is an A, this is a B, you know, this type of thing. That isn't what teaching is all about. It's mm-hmm. how you present it. It's how you conduct yourself in the classroom. It's how you make sure that you take every child and give them the support that they need in order to learn. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you want to just go, you got to know this, come on. But mm-hmm. they don't, you know. Mm-hmm. One of the challenges was when I would teach beginning reading is, you know, 18 different ways to teach the sound of D. You know, mm-hmm. they didn't get it. So back to the, you know, to back to your original question, I get off the task here. I would talk a lot with them. You know, we just sit down and talk, and I would say to them, you know, what did you think went well today? Mm-hmm. You know, write it down. What did you feel needs improvement? Write it down. I said, now that's something you can work on for the next month. Mm-hmm. Come to me, go to your team leader, go to, you know, your mentor. Let them help you too. And it worked for me. Mm-hmm. When I did student teaching after I retired in 95, I went to work for Bowling Green State University for 6.5 years, and I supervised student teachers, did all their seminars, things like that. And I learned a lot there that I wished I knew when I was principal, because you know, I picked up a lot of good ideas from the people that I worked with.
It sounds like, for, you know, education is always evolving. There's some things that, you know, remain maybe a constant, but the new ideas and innovation, you know, kind of change what goes on in the classroom and in the profession as a whole. Is there anything that you think that you would like to see change in the profession? I know we've gone through, you know, there's been the controversy of No Child Left Behind, and, you know, there have been some things that just haven't worked. And what about today? When you look back over the time,
I have a lot of ideas on that. They aren't very popular, though, I'm sure. I think, first of all, we need to change our whole feeling towards teachers. They need more respect. I don't think what they do gets enough respect. Education is such an important facet of, you know, of a child's life, of an adult's life. You know, what do they say now, that, you know, people or the kids that graduate today all have 14 jobs or something like that. And so we have to somehow get the best teachers in there to help prepare these kids mm-hmm. for that. We need better methods of funding. Mm-hmm. You know, our administrators, so much of my time and even more of the superintendent's time is not spent working on education in a sense. It's spent trying to get money so that we can educate. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't have to spend all that time going out and begging for money. Mm-hmm. When I was principal, we had a psychologist that was a great grant writer. And she and I worked well together. I'd give her the idea, she'd write the grant. Mm-hmm. She did a much better job writing it than I would. We started a public preschool. We were one of the first ones in the state to do that. We got this was back, you know, 20 years ago. We got a grant for like $400,000 to start this. I mean, there was no way that we would have this kind of money. Mm-hmm. But you probably are aware how much time it mm-hmm. takes to write a grant. Well, when you use that time to write grants, you're neglecting something else. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's things like that that are so wrong. There seems to be a crumbling of public education. I don't know what other word to use for it. And when you look back in history, mm-hmm. public education, you know, the mandate that every child should have an education is what made the United States what the United States is. Mm-hmm. And private schools have, you know, they have a right to mm-hmm. have a private school. That's fine. With the changing of the standards, what it gave to, you know, the private school has the right to say, we don't want this child. Mm-hmm. So where does that child go? Mm-hmm. To public education. And that child has that right to public education. Mm-hmm. We started an inclusion program, though. It was a state model, again, where special needs children were integrated right into the regular classroom. They were in the homerooms. Art, music, PE, all that type of thing, any subject that they could handle. And so many times special needs children may have trouble reading, but they were good in math. They could go into a regular math. Mm-hmm. We'd have special ed teachers that would go into the classroom and work with the regular ed teacher so that those kids had that chance. They weren't segregated. That costs money. Mm-hmm. It costs a lot of money. And if you have a gifted child out there and you see a child that's in a wheelchair, mm-hmm. you know, you feel like my child should have more of an education than that child in a wheelchair. And I don't think that's the way it's meant to be.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point, because I think people forget that sometimes, especially children with certain disabilities, can contribute a great deal. And the brain is an interesting thing. I learned a lot, actually, when I was substitute teaching in special needs classes. Mm-hmm. I actually learned probably more about education and about educating the child. Yeah, and that's another thing people don't understand is the whole concept, I think, or I should say many people don't understand what special ed is about and what it really means mm-hmm. in terms of education. And you mentioned inclusion, because I think people, there's some myths surrounding that as well.
Oh, there's a lot of people that are so against that. But then, if you have a parent, or you're a parent of a special needs children, you want it. You know, mm-hmm. you want it. You know, it's just one of those things that, and of course, this district is known for the way they educate special needs children, and that's why we have so many, mm-hmm. because people will move into the district so that they can get that education. And like I said before, most people don't realize how expensive that type of education is. Mm-hmm. I always said the most neglected child in the school was the average child. Mm-hmm. Because, first of all, you know, there was 25 of them in the classroom. They did what you told them to, and they just worked along. They had no extras, you know. Mm-hmm. But they would achieve fine because they were average. But, you know, the special needs, you have occupational therapists, you have physical therapists, you know, you have special physical education teachers, you know, speech therapists, so it goes on and on to help them out. But it pays off, I think, in the end, because we have a lot of special needs children that are good providers in society. So mm-hmm. what do you do?
Let me ask you a question. There was a book recently written, I'm trying to think of the title, called something about the dumbest generation. And sometimes we hear this on the news. Are students not as smart as they were 20 years ago? I know that's a loaded question.
I know. I don't know. I think students have been the same intelligence all along. It's just how you harness that intelligence. But it is a good question.
You know, maybe this, you know, you wonder about with technology changing things. Perhaps, you know, maybe looking back in history, whenever there have been shifts in society in terms of social and economic shifts, until we've gotten through that process, we're not sure of the outcome because things are strange to us, whether it be the texting and the use of the smart board and how they're whizzes at certain things, but yet, you know, we, you know, like many parents and people or teachers, are driven crazy by the texting messages and then using that same type of texting lingo in their composition. So,
oh yes, after you teach them how to spell, and then that's quite the challenge for teachers, I'm sure.
Would you go back into teaching today?
Definitely. I loved the profession. I loved the kids. I loved working with the adults, the parents, the teachers. To me, it's the greatest profession in the world. So,
your daughter's a teacher, correct?
Yes. Here
in the school district.
Yes. And what she wanted to be a teacher from the word go, and she's very organized and. You know, she knows, she always knew what she wanted to do, and I tried talking her out of it because at that time there was an overabundance of teachers, and you know, it was just going through a rough time. This was in the late 80s and 90s, and she didn't listen to me, which I'm kind of glad she didn't now, because she's a good teacher, and she loves it.
She teaches second grade, correct?
This year she's teaching second grade.
Okay.
She was one of, I told you about the preschool grant. She was one of the preschool teachers. She started up the preschool at Berlin and was a preschool teacher for 7 or 8 years. And then she burned out because that is a hard job. And it was integrated. So there were special needs children in there too. That was part of the grant, that you had an equal amount of regular ed children, you had equal amount of special needs children in order to keep the grant. So, and then she went, I think she went to third, then to first, and then second. So, but she loves it.
What do you think your greatest accomplishment was as a teacher and as a principal?
As a teacher, I was happier teaching than I was as a principal, only because I could work closely with kids. Teaching hundreds of children how to read, I would say, was my biggest accomplishment. Because, and I still, you know, I'll see, you know, some kids and say, "You remember me?" "Yeah." And I taught you how to read. He said, "Yes, you did." You know, so, you know, that to me was that's what was so much fun about working in primary, is to see these kids come in and they couldn't read. Of course, now they can read in kindergarten. I think some, you know, they're teaching them to read when they're 2 years old. So I guess it's not such a big accomplishment anymore. But yeah, that was my biggest one. As principal, it was probably working on the inclusion programs and getting the preschool program going. And it wasn't my accomplishment by any means. It was a group of people that did that. Back to the, you know, you work together in a group and you accomplish greater things.
What about the Milan, the Berlin-Milan community as a whole? What what can you say about...
It's the greatest community. Both of them are, and they're so alike now. At one time, and see, and I went through all the turmoil of the merger, but both communities are just such wonderful small communities. I mean, they care about their kids. I mean, look at the booster clubs, and look at the sports programs that they have going. The libraries. Look at how many things go on in the libraries. You don't find this much in a larger city. Just, you know, everybody. You know, people care about each other. the volunteers. I could just go on and on and on. Mm-hmm. That's why I come back so often.
And that's what others have said, the other participants, talking about how the community has rallied for many things, whether it be education, illness, or things that are part of the community and of what small communities mm-hmm. tend to do.
Right. I mean, some of the benefits, I mean, these people have been helped so much, you know, and some of these people are, you know, are close to me. So, and it's just amazing what, and once again, it's a group of people working together that mm-hmm. create this.
Is there anything that you would like to add?
Let's see. One of the questions you thought about, too, was what advice would I give to new teachers?
I was going to ask you that to wrap things up, certainly.
Okay. First of all, I'd let them know that, in my opinion, they chose the best profession in the world. I mean, there's nothing better than working with children, whether they're 3 years old or 16. Be flexible, because if you're not flexible, you're not going to survive in the classroom, because you might have a beautiful lesson plan, and if there's a fire drill or somebody throws up, or you know, there's a special occasion going on, your lesson plan's out the door. Don't let it upset you. You know, you need a sense of humor. If you can't laugh, you're going to cry. Mm-hmm. It's as simple as that. And when you're working, especially with elementary kids, there's so much to laugh about. But you have to make sure that they know that you're laughing with them and not at them. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we used to have some fun times, and the kids, you know, would laugh. Don't let the negatives get you down, because my philosophy was, you know, if I got a call from an angry parent and they just read me the riot act, now I'd handle the problem as best I could, try to solve it. And then, you know, somebody would say, how do you stand that? And I said, well, my philosophy is this. If we didn't have a few bad things happen to us in our life, we wouldn't appreciate the multiple good things that happen to us. The other thing, and this came from a kindergarten teacher that I just admired so much, and she would always say to the kids, it's okay to make a mistake. That's how you're going to learn. And I think if children see you admitting that you made a mistake, a lot of times when I was teaching, you know, I'd spell a word wrong on purpose, and somebody'd say, oh, you know, you didn't spell that word right. And I said, oh, thank you, I made a mistake, but we can correct it. And I think so many times if they make a mistake, they feel that they're a failure. And I you can't learn if you don't make a mistake. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, you know, I always thought, somebody would say, well, that was a good learning experience. And I said, yeah, and it hurt. Mm-hmm. And so many times when you do have a learning experience, it's going to hurt. Mm-hmm. And then wish them all the luck in the world. So,
Anything else to add about that to teachers or
no,
advice?
I think that's enough advice. That's an awful lot for them to take.
What about with parents? How do we as parents prepare our children?
Well,
to come into the classroom,
love them, give them as many experiences you can. Another one of my little philosophies is that parent is sending you the very best that they have. Honor that. So, you know, we always when we started out conferences, we started it out with something that was good. Mm-hmm. You know, and sometimes you really had to search for mm-hmm. something that could be very positive. But then when you started thinking about it, oh, you know, he helps other kids, or, you know, he might hit them, mm-hmm. but then he'll turn around and pick up something for mm-hmm. him, you know, that type of thing. So, and I look at parents that way, you know, that they're doing the best they can. So many times I think we didn't appreciate what some of the parents were going through, mm-hmm. especially like single parents. You know, they had to provide, you know, food, shelter mm-hmm. For that child. And they, you know, by the time they got home, they didn't have time to sit down and mm-hmm. practice their flashcards with them or things like that, as much as we felt that they should. Mm-hmm. So I think if you really look at parents and what they're trying to tell you, there's always a good reason why things are the way they are. But and we could tell, you know, so many children came into school so well prepared because, you know, they went to the zoo, they mm-hmm. took trips, they went to the museums, they, you know, they, parents talked to them. My biggest advice was always read to your child. Try, you know, at least try every night to read mm-hmm. to your child, because they'll, you know, it's a good bonding time for both of you, plus it just helps that child understand the importance of reading mm-hmm. and the enjoyment of reading.
Right. Is there anything else you'd like to add about?
Yeah, I think I've talked enough.
Oh, I think you've had wonderful things to say, and you know, about the teaching profession to help people understand living here in the community. And I thank you so much for the interview.
You're very welcome.